free speech with any kind of issue about the salt. Those are two widely different categories. But listen, let's just put all.
Can I ask you about Tesla real quick before we get to the guest? Because I know there was something big you wanted to talk about with regard to Tesla this week.
Tesla is now losing $1 billion a quarter. It's never made a profit, and it has $8 or $10 billion in debt. And I don't have any idea why investors think it's worth more money than Ford or GM. And it's, I could talk about it constantly, you know, continually. It's just completely insane. And I think it's the poster child, along with the price of a lot of these cryptocurrencies, of the excesses that are in our financial markets because of what's happened in the credit markets. And by the way, you know, it's all coming unraveled. You mentioned Venezuela. They're in default. They're the first big sovereign default, and it certainly won't be the last. There's a lot of things that are in our financial markets that don't make any sense. Tesla is one of them. You know, Buck, we have a world-class global economist, Grant Williams, for the interview this week, and he can actually talk more about Venezuela and Tesla than I can. He's been following these stories for as long as I have, and he's the real expert. So why don't we bring Grant on now, and we'll get to the rest of the show in a minute.
Grant Williams is co-founder of Real Vision Group and has more than 30 years of experience in finance, during which time he held senior positions at investment banks in London, Tokyo, New York, Sydney, and Singapore. Grant is also the publisher of Things That Make You Go, a newsletter combining history and humor along with keen financial insights to help investors make sense of a misunderstood and ever-changing financial landscape. Williams is also the co-founder of Real Vision TV, the world's only video-on-demand channel for finance, and has been described by some as the Netflix for finance geeks. Real Vision's content features exclusive interviews and presentations from the world's best hedge fund managers, independent analysis, geopolitical strategists, and economists. Guests have included Jim Grant, Kyle Bass, Mark Cuban, and Jim Rogers. Grant Williams is a frequent speaker at investment conferences across the globe and recently gave a captivating presentation to over 700 Stansberry readers at the Stansberry Conference in Las Vegas, titled A World of Pure Imagination. Porter sat down with Grant earlier today, and this is what they had to say.
Grant, thank you so much for being on the podcast with us. I have followed your work for, I don't know, at least a decade. And the thing that strikes me about what you do as compared to pretty much any other writer about finance or any other economist, whether they work for a bank or whether they work for a publishing group, is no one comes close to making their presentations as entertaining as you do. Now, listen, I'm not trying to tell you that you're a stand-up comedian or anything like that. Your work is dense and rich with facts and insights, but your presentation quality is just stunning. Our audience by far voted you the highest-rated speaker. 700 people agreed with me, so this isn't just a matter of taste. What is it in your background, in your education, or in your history of working in investment banking? How did you get to be such a fantastic speaker?
Well, that's extremely kind, Porter. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on. I'm sure I've been told many times in my career that as a trader or a financial analyst, I make a great stand-up comedian. So maybe I listened to a few people's advice. But do you know what? I think there's too many. Finance is a pretty dry subject, let's face it. And so to me, it was always a case of if you can make it a little bit more engaging, a little bit more entertaining, you've got a better chance of holding the audience and actually trying to take them on a journey with you instead of just presenting them with a whole bunch of facts and figures and trying to let them sift through them and pick out what they think is important. I think if you can weave a story or a narrative through a set of figures, then, as I say, you've got a better chance of taking people with you. And look, I mean, it's right now it's a pretty depressing subject, so it pays to try and liven it up a little bit any way you can, whether that's through humor or whether it's through you know, a bit of music or something, just to kind of try and bring it to life. Was all I've really ever tried to do.
Right now, I would say the dominant themes of your presentations, and also, by the way, sort of the dominant themes that I see in finance, is this. You called it a world of pure imagination. And I've called it the Escher economy, where It's just hard to know where the circle starts and stops, because the money gets printed and the system gets warped, and then the warp becomes the system again. And I just wondered, off the top of your head, have you seen any more fantastic illustrations of this? I have a couple of ideas in mind I want to ask you about, but in your world of pure imagination, or in my Escher economy, are there any more of these little stories that just seem absolutely too strange to be true, but are?
Well, I think, you know, what really astounds me, and that the whole idea of the presentation we're talking about, this world of pure imagination, was just to try and take a step back. And, you know, we live this every day. We've kind of grown up with this strange world being created around us. And sometimes when you do that, you know, I hate to use that boiling frog analogy, but it's so apt in this particular case. When it's happening gradually around you, it's very easy to just become inured to the whole thing. And so the point of this presentation was to step back and say, hey, you know what, just take a look at this in isolation. Forget the fact that how we got here. Step back and look at these charts. Look at a chart of the S&P 500, which you know shows that we're so far beyond what were previously acknowledged as massive bubbles. Take a look at negative interest rates, the whole idea of negative interest rates in isolation, not as part of the construct, but think about that as a concept. Look at the fact that European junk bonds are yielding less than U.S. treasuries. You know, each of these standalone pieces of the puzzle is extraordinary, and at any point in the last 5,000 years of interest rate history, they would have all made you sit there and go, well, that can't be right. But because they've all kind of gradually happened in this post-crisis quantitative easing fueled economy, people have kind of come to accept them. And the fact that the money printing is continuing, and the fact that no major accidents have happened since 2009, we've had a couple of wobbles, but each time they were dealt with by more of the same, more of the medicine. And the fact that nothing bad seemingly has happened has just made people think, well, you know, maybe it doesn't matter. And the point of my presentation is just to say, look, it does matter. It may not have mattered, but these things have a habit of not mattering to anybody until they matter to everybody. And when they do matter to everybody, and people kind of see this world for what it is, that they're forced to take that step back, I think they're going to suddenly think, geez, how the hell did we get here, and have to do something about it? And doing something about it, I think, might be pretty ugly for the markets.
Yeah, and you know, Grant, I agree with you about all of these things, which is, of course, why we invited you on the podcast. So I'm not trying to make an argument with you, more of a rhetorical argument that you and I are both going to agree on. But when you say that nothing bad has happened yet, I think it really just sort of depends on what lens you're taking when you look at it. Because if I told you 5 years ago that Netflix was going to spend $8 billion in 1 year on content and will have not made a profit in the last 5 years, you'd think, how does that get financed? Or if you knew, again, 5 years ago that Tesla would have a larger market capitalization than GM or Ford, would have $1 billion a quarter losses, and would already owe bondholders something close to $10 billion, you'd wonder, how the hell did that get financed? And if you know that AT&T is looking to raise additional bonds that will carry its total debt load to $250 billion, which is more than the sovereign Republic of Ireland, you'd think, how the hell does that get financed? And so I think if you look just below the surface of stock prices, you see a whole ton of financings that don't make any sense. Like in the United States, college students now owe $1.5 trillion, more than $1 trillion in credit card debt. And of course, you know even more than I do about how the corporate bond market globally has been massively inflated. And so, like you just said, we're going to wake up in a couple of days or a couple of weeks or a couple of months and go, how the hell did we get here? But how can you tell that story to the average person or to the average policymaker who genuinely doesn't even understand what real interest rates are?
Well, it's a great question. And I think you've hit the nail on the head. And when I say nothing bad has happened, what I'm talking about is what people look as their benchmark for something bad happening, which tends to be the stock market falling or there being some kind of rout in the bond market. You know, those things haven't happened. But everything you've just talked about is something bad that has happened. It just hasn't added up to something quantifiable. You're absolutely right about Netflix. You're absolutely right about Tesla, and I talked about that in my presentation. It's ludicrous. You know, all this stuff is ludicrous in isolation, and it should add up to major problems in markets. But because it hasn't, because that manifestation in a way that people can understand hasn't happened, people have become conditioned to the idea that it doesn't matter. And that's the worrying thing. You know, we had this moment in time a couple of years ago when 23% of the world's GDP was being produced by countries that had negative interest rates. And that was a moment in time. And you kind of thought, well, how can this happen? But within a couple of years, the idea of negative interest rates isn't so shocking to people anymore because they've seen them. They assumed the wheels would fall off, but they didn't. So they go, oh, okay, well, obviously that doesn't matter. And we're about to enter into, or we've already entered into a period of rising interest rates. Now, I think that will get squashed fairly soon when it does some damage, because it will do damage. It always does damage. And one of the slides in my presentation showed that since World War II, the by far the biggest cause of recessions have been monetary policy mistakes, by far. So the Fed will hike one time too many in this hike. Maybe it's the hike in December. Maybe it's a hike next year. We don't know. But this idea of a rising interest rate environment, if you were to have managed money the last time we had a secular trending interest rate rise environment, you're now in your 60s. So there aren't many people around managing money today who have experienced a rising interest rate environment. And that's what we're in right now. Things have changed. They may not have manifested themselves, but the environment has changed. And so the fact that people haven't adjusted to that yet is really not the important thing to focus on. It's really trying to work out, okay, when is all this going to matter? What's going to be the trigger? And when it does matter, what's going to be the reaction? And the reaction to valuations like these in equity markets, if you suddenly believe that interest rates are going higher, is the markets move lower. If you think interest rates are going higher, the bond market moves lower. We are going to see these things unfold as it plays out. But the world we've created around ourselves is simply, I'm not going to worry about anything until it happens because I don't have to. Central banks have my back. The markets go up every day, and I will always be able to get out if things change. And I think all of those are going to be proven to be fallacies.
Well, I'd like for you to speculate for just a minute. You and I both agree on the underlying cause of this world of pure imagination, this Escher economy. And you and I both have a matching intuition that things that can't go on forever won't. But how they will break apart is totally unknown. And like Yogi Berra said, you know, predicting the future is hard, especially about things that haven't happened yet.
Right.
So I've got an interesting factoid here. Recently, the Bank of Japan did a stress analysis on what a 100 basis point rise in interest rates would do to the banking system. Now, for those of you who aren't traders or finance folks, 100 basis points is 1%. So if the funding costs of Japanese banks went from where it is now at less than 1% to say 1.5%. So a 1% increase or 100 basis points, as the traders call it, what would happen? And the Bank of Japan estimates that that kind of move, which is a very, very minor move in interest rates, would lead to a $20 billion loss for Japan's mega banks, which they could probably absorb, a loss of $25 billion for its regional banks, which they probably couldn't absorb, and a loss of $20 billion for its credit unions, which they definitely couldn't absorb. And so, to make the point that you were just making, as interest rates rise, there are new stresses on financial institutions, especially anybody who's borrowed short to lend long, and the losses can be just as spectacular as the gains have been on the way up. So my question for you, Grant, is what breaks first? Is it Japanese banks? Is it European banks? Is it the American consumer? Is it global manufacturing? Where do all of these malinvestments and all of this misallocation of capital, where does it finally spin apart?
Well, it's a great question, and I think that's the $64,000 question, because for the first time I can remember, there are potential stumbling blocks everywhere. You look at the bond market, look at the equity market, look at the real estate market, look at Japan, look at Europe, look at the US, everywhere you can find something that could be the trigger for this. You know, I think the US consumer is broken already. But again, it hasn't mattered because they can still have access to cheap debt, which is keeping them afloat, and they are financing. You can see it in the data; they're financing their everyday absolute must-have purchases on their credit cards. The data's clear, but because they can afford to do that still, just even though when you look at the survey details, it's like 1 in 10 people doesn't have $5,000 in the bank to cope with an emergency. These things are all predicated. This whole system now is predicated on keeping rates at a level which is, we've only once reached this level in 5,000 years of recorded history, and that's now. So if you've been short the environment we're in now, you would have been wrong precisely once in the last 5,000 years, and that's a pretty good risk-reward profile. So for me, this is all about rates. This is all about the fact that the difference between going from 6% to 7% is completely different to the difference between going from 1% to 2% in terms of the cost of your financing. And that's where we're at. The quantum of a 1% move higher down here is massive. And so I suspect it's going to be rates that break this thing. It's going to be, as I said, the Fed hiking one time too many because they feel they could just squeeze another 25 basis point or 0.25% rise out of things. And at that point, if they do break things and they have to come back in and cut rates immediately, then I think this narrative about the economy being strong, the economy recovering, is suddenly blown out of the water. And if you believe the economy is blown out of the water and the economy is perhaps heading for recession, and as I said earlier, Fed hikes always lead to recession at some point, then the markets are overvalued. It's simple. They are not valued correctly for an economy that's about to go into recession. And you know, we are in the third longest expansion of all time in the US, and it's by far the weakest recovery. And that's a very bad combination. But as long as rates stay where they are, it's kind of financeable. But it doesn't take an awful lot for those stresses, as you pointed out, to start mounting very, very quickly. And at this point in the cycle, if the only solution we have is more debt to keep this thing going, at some point people are just going to look at the total debt load and say, you know, I'm not prepared to lend to these companies at 2%. I'm going to want 4% as a risk reward for my money. And so to me, it's going to be one hike too many, and it's going to be an interest rate problem that tips somewhere, whether it's in Southeast Asia, whether it's the student loan problem, whether it is car loans, I don't know, but delinquencies are inching up. They're still not at the kind of levels we saw that led to the Great Recession in 2008. But again, we were coming from a sort of 5% yield on the 2-year Treasury at that point. So to me, that's what's going to tip it. And I think people should be paying very, very close attention to that because we're on a real knife edge.
Let me ask you a broader question about the financial system as a whole. And you know, as an American publisher, I'm really dealing mostly with questions about American finance and the American financial system. But the American financial system has been copied all over the world in terms of a central bank and paper money and the way that central banks are managing economies all over the G20. So you know, you have more of a global view, and I'm sure you can apply these concepts into the other economies just like I'm applying them in America. But there's a couple of things that seem very clear to me, and the general hypothesis is that something about the way we've organized the financial system isn't working at all. And just a couple of things that I'll point out to you here, little factoids. In America currently, the top 10th of 1% of the population now owns assets equal to the bottom 90%. So when people talk about the 1%, what they really should be talking about is the 10th of the 1%. That's the largest skew since the Great Depression. And it's not all the problem isn't only the wealth gap, as it's called. If you look at how much money and credit has been created since 2008, you know, you'll find that sovereign debt in America has more than doubled. You'll find that consumer debt is already back at new all-time highs. But despite this, despite how much consumption has been pulled forward through the issuance of this debt, Obama was the first president in American history that never saw annual GDP growth during his presidency of more than 2%. So it never reached 3% in any year for any part of his presidency. That's a first. So, Grant, think about that for a second. We had an eight-year period where we have added more debt than ever before, but even all that additional consumption, all that additional consumption didn't lead to sustained GDP growth. And then you've got some other interesting economic problems. How do you explain the continuing decline in the velocity of money despite all of this inflationary pressure? And how do you and how do you explain the rise of all of these very unusual phenomena, like the cryptocurrency bubble that we're seeing? And you and I have already talked about the huge bubble in entertainment and media assets. So you put all these things together, and then the coup de grace for me is that in America, the link between productivity gains and wages has been broken for 40 years. That is an enormous macroeconomic concept. That was the tightest link correlation in all of economics, and it's completely broken under this current financial system. So the question I have for you is, one, do you agree with me that there is something fundamentally wrong with the way the central banks have organized our economies, and something fundamentally wrong with the way paper currency is working by not transmitting gains in productivity to wages and allowing massive accumulations of wealth through paper credit? And two, if you do agree with that, will the coming correction, bear market, however you want to describe it, will the coming correction be the one that leads to an entire financial reordering?
Well, this concept of a financial reordering, of a reimagination of the financial system, is such a hard thing for people to understand, but it's happened periodically throughout history. This is not an outlier. It just happens that we have lived through 46 years of a purely fiat regime, first one in history. And so, again, to my point about these things being built around us, that's what's happened to us. So it's unimaginable to most people for there to be a major change. But history is replete with examples of that thing. You touched on two things there. First of all, the link between wages and productivity, which I think is absolutely the most important thing. This idea that real wages haven't gone anywhere in 40 years is a really difficult thing for people to understand, particularly when they look at how the cost of their food shopping each week and their rent accommodation and house prices and, you know, all the things, healthcare. I mean, these things have gone up. The world is becoming more and more unaffordable. And then when you throw in the other stat about M2 and this crushing of the velocity of money, you know, the answer is hiding in there. You know, what's happened in this age of quantitative easing, this massive printing of $12 trillion globally of quantitative easing, that money has gone to that 0.1% that you spoke about. You know, asset prices have inflated, and it is the 0.1% who own the assets. And so if you inflate the value of the assets owned by the 0.1% who have a very low propensity to spend, that money doesn't go into the real economy. They don't need to realize the gains and spend them in the real economy. They just sit getting richer, and their land valuations and their art portfolios. You know, we had a Leonardo da Vinci painting sell this week for $450 million. It's half a billion dollars for a painting. So when people talk about, well, look, there hasn't been any inflation, they're looking in the wrong place. You know, the CPI hasn't moved, and the central banks are desperately trying to get the CPI to move. But if you look at 7-8 years ago, if I told you you'd be earning $100 million and you couldn't afford to buy the most expensive apartment in New York City, you'd think I was crazy, but that's the truth of it. You know, there's a $200 million duplex going up for sale in the new Nordstrom Tower. It's extraordinary. So all this asset price inflation has done is make that 0.1% richer. And again, you know, I'm a great student of history. I love reading history, and this has happened so many times before, and it always leads to societal instability, which is what we're seeing. And it generally ends very badly for that 0.1%. And I think, judging by a lot of articles I've read and people I've spoken to, they are starting to sense that, okay, there is a major imbalance here. And that could explain the rise of something like Bitcoin, where you have the 0.1% in China, the gap is bigger than it is in the US, the 0.1% in Saudi, same thing. And so, you know, I think the people that have assets, have money, are looking for ways to get that money offshore, get it somewhere, quote unquote, safe. And until we get a change in the way that this system is managed, these imbalances aren't going to be corrected. And that's where this idea of a reimagination of the financial system comes in. And you've got people suggesting that communism may be the answer because of this inequality. Now, again, history will tell you that communism is never the answer, but that doesn't mean people won't think it's worth another try. And to think that the society we live in and the freedoms that we've managed to engineer for ourselves over the last sort of 50, 60, 70 years in terms of technological improvements, to think that that society would have as many people as it does in it thinking, well, you know what, maybe communism's the answer because capitalism doesn't work. And I put it to you that capitalism does work, but what we have now is not capitalism. It's certainly not free market capitalism. It's state-sponsored capitalism where, as I said, the 0.1% get richer and the 99.9% don't. And that not only has to change, but it will change somehow. If it's not changed through design, it will be changed through circumstance. And that circumstantial change is always the kind of change that societies really don't want to go through because they're very volatile changes, full of the kind of upheavals that we haven't seen again for the last 40 or 50 years. So we assumed that they were gone for good, and I just don't think they are.
Grant, you've been very kind to spend so much time with us this evening. I know it's very late in Singapore, and I really just have one more question for you, and it's not a hard question. It's not a finance question. You have lived in virtually all of the great cities, London, Tokyo, New York, Sydney, Singapore, and probably a couple others I'm not mentioning. Having traveled so widely and spent so much time in so many places, if you had all the money in the world and all the time in the world, but you could only pick one city to live in the rest of your days, or maybe even not a city, maybe someplace else, where would it be? Where is it in the world that you've been that you think is a really fine place to spend time?
Wow, that's the hardest question of all. You know, to me, my favorite city in the world is New York. There's something about New York that just feels like I'm home. But if you put me down somewhere and I wasn't allowed to move, it would be Charleston, South Carolina, which may come out of the blue for a lot of people. But I think anyone that's been there will just be nodding their heads quietly and going, yep. And anyone that hasn't should go and take a look at it because it's just a spectacular part of the world.
Very good. Not many people can give a succinct answer to a question like that. So I appreciate the fine thinking that went into it. And, of course, I have spent a lot of time in Charleston, and it is a great city. It's a city that's about people and not about money or about commerce.
Exactly.
Or any of those other things. And that's one of the things that makes it great. So, listen, Grant, thank you so much for your time today. And I hope that we'll see each other soon and do a lot more business in the days to come.
I look forward to it, Porter. Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Bye-bye.